Hey, this is Cody from Big Business, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, thanks for that, Cody. Hey, everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in this week. We are speaking with Big Business drummer Cody Willis. Now, Big Biz has a new LP coming out in April, The Beast You Are, which is available in various pressings. There's splatter versions, a VIP edition, there are limited pressings, etc. Go to joyfulnoiserecordings.com to see the selection for yourself. Now, Cody has spent many years in the industry playing with various vinyl-friendly bands, including nearly 10 years with Melvins, playing, recording, and living alongside Buzz Osborne and Dale Crover. Now, today, Cody's going to share his musical history and discuss all things vinyl from his musically checkered past. Now, he is in the two-piece band Big Business, and their new LP, The Beast You Are, is quite phenomenal. We're going to play a track from the new Big Business LP, The Beast You Are. If you're not familiar with Big Biz, hopefully this will get you into the mood. And whether you're new to Big Business or have a collection of their various pressings and a sea of Melvins and Murder City Devils records, you're going to need to keep them clean to sound their very best. Enter the Groove Washer record cleaner. Now, personally, I use Groove Washer every single day, multiple times a day, in fact, and I can confirm it is the best manual record cleaner out on the market. Groove Washer prices start at less than $20, and you get an extra 10% off with promo code VinylGuide10 at checkout. That's groovewasher.com. Clean your records and hear the difference at groovewasher.com. Promo code VinylGuide10. And if you're already a fan of Big Business and or Cody Willis's past work, you are going to enjoy many of the episodes we have in the Vinyl Guide archives, including episode number 67, featuring an interview with Buzz Osborne of Melvins, talking all about the band's history and vinyl record pressings, a bunch of the rare records they have in their catalog. That's episode 67 of The Vinyl Guide, available at thevinylguide.com. Also, don't forget episode number 54 with Red Fang's Brian Giles, episode number 77 with Brant Bjork, formerly of Caius, and then, of course, more recently, episode number 120 featuring Stephen McDonald, bassist extraordinaire with Melvins, Off, Red Cross, and a whole bunch of others. All these episodes are available anytime to listen to at thevinylguide.com. And with that, let's warm up the masses with a track from the new Big Business LP, The Beast You Are. This track is called Let Them Grind. Enjoy.
Yeah.
So this week on The Vinyl Guide, we have big business drummer Cody Willis with us. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Hey, I got to tell you, the new record, The Beast You Are, is phenomenal. I sometimes get early press albums, generally like MP3s and stuff like that. I get to hear things early sometimes, and I've been listening to this new LP pretty much, you know, for the last week and a half. It's also my introduction to big business, too. I haven't been too familiar up to this point. And the denseness, the melodies, the layers, every time I hear something different. So one of the questions I wanted to confirm right off the bat, are the two of you going to be able to replicate these songs live?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's, when you're seeing a live show, you also get like the visual, and there's like the I feel like there, you know, whatever PA system you're in front of, it's almost like it's so loud, and you have the energy of the people around you and everything. So we never really worried too much about making it sound exactly like the record. You have all these other elements like working in your favor. It'll be great. Anyway, I mean, and we write these songs, we, you know, kind of wrote them playing as a two-piece, you know, in mind that we'd be able to do it. So a lot of the stuff that maybe you think wouldn't be covered, we do have covered for a live performance. And some of the, you know, obviously like the deep, you know, like multi-vocal layers and everything like that won't be there. But you won't know. There's so much other stuff going on, you won't know the difference. It's you're just going to be, your skin's going to be peeled back. It's so amazing. Yeah. No, we don't really worry about that too much. You know, it's like, it's fun to be in the studio and layer up all the bells and whistles as much as you can, knowing that like when you get, you know, when you play these songs live, of course, it's not going to sound exactly like the record, but there's all these other elements going on. So a lot of that stuff takes care of itself.
When you guys are recording and you decide on another layer or another element in the recording, do you kind of look at each other like, oh, okay, well, this is going to mean you have to, Jared, you have to do something different here when we play this live? Is that level of communication and introspection when you're doing the recording?
No, we don't worry about that. Like, if it sounds good on the record, we'll put it on the record. If it fits in the song and it sounds good, that's, we never worry about like, we'll never be able to pull that off. We haven't really recorded anything, I don't think, that would be totally impossible to pull off live. So it's just not a consideration, I guess. Okay. The live show and the recorded album are two different animals completely.
Okay. It sounds like I'm doing all the worrying for you here.
I appreciate it.
No worries. Look, being in a two-piece band, that's a tremendous space to fill. So there's not a lot of drumming, 4/4 timing. So each show must really be a workout for you, yeah?
Yeah, you get used to it. It's okay. There's little secret places to take breaks and breathe. And it is one of those things where, like, usually on tour, like after the first three shows, my body's like, ugh! And then it just plateaus after that. Then it's fine.
Do you tour with guitarists or guests ever filling in, helping out, or is it almost always just the two of you?
Well, we started as a two-piece. The first two records we did, we had like guest star guitar players here and there just to like fill some stuff in. And then we brought in our friend Toshi Gasai on our third record to be our permanent guitar player. And toured with him for a while as a three piece. And then Toshi is a record producer. He records all the Melvins records. He's the Melvins engineer and everything. So that's what he's been like, you know, that's what he really loves doing. And so it kind of got to be where he wasn't as happy on the road as he was at home making records. So he started phasing into that. And then we brought on, our friend Scott Martin to have the guitar duties for a while. That kind of didn't happen after a while, that we parted ways after that. And we just kind of went back to like, we had to do a European tour we had scheduled with Mastodon. And this was coming up and we parted ways with our guitar player. So we had to go back to being a two piece, like on the fly really quick. And we had to do this tour after not being a two piece for a number of years. We had to be thrown right back into it and it was totally fine. Nobody seemed to be bummed out at all. And it just felt better. It felt right.
Being a two-piece must simplify things. I mean, you guys, there's two people to make decisions. You guys could practically tour in a Prius if you needed to.
Yeah, if it wasn't for all the guitar cabinets, we probably could. But yeah, it is. It makes things a lot faster. Things get done a lot quicker. But it also is like there's an extra workload in terms of like, I guess, administrative duties, like making decisions and making sure everything happens on the business side of things too. There's a lot more to do.
Now, a question for you: when you're touring, and obviously you alluded to the multiple cabinets you need to bring on tour, of course your drum kits and everything, but merchandise, touring with vinyl. These days, a lot of bands are bringing vinyl on the road with them. You spent 10 years or so with the Melvins, who are solidly at the far end of that spectrum, but Murder City Devils, I'm sure Big Business does it too. What's the response to vinyl being sold at shows? Is it a big moneymaker for the band?
Absolutely. Like I feel like it's like the cornerstone. It's strange that vinyl's come back in such a way that, I mean, it's a more of a boutique item now, I guess. Like, it's not a thing that's considered like a mass produced thing. It's people seem really more into buying something that's limited edition, or there's something special about, you know, a small run of vinyl that, you know, there's only 500 of these, and people get really excited about that. And I think it's great because we don't have to, you know, it's just finding new ways to make it make sense and make it be a cool thing that people want to have, but it's not a mass produced product anymore, you know, but I think it's great. I think people, I like listening to music on vinyl, and I think it's a cooler way to package music. Like, there's a lot more to look at, and it's like you're actually buying a piece of art. You're buying this big thing that you can, you know, hold in your hand, and it's cooler to me, and I'm glad people are into it. I'm glad it hasn't, like, disappeared completely, you know?
When you tour and create these special limited pressings, do you get involved in that decision at all? Do you say, you know, hey, okay. Like, for instance, people seeing Big Business coming up, what do they have to look forward to on the merch table, vinyl-wise?
Well, like, the new record that's coming out, you can buy, there's a limited edition. I think it's almost gone already. I think there's, like, maybe 50 copies left. We did a 500 run of it's a special colored vinyl. I think it's like electric blue, transparent with blue and green splatter is the vinyl. And it also comes with a slip knot and an embroidered patch. I think we're putting a autographed glossy headshot of our handsome faces in there. And there's something else. It's quite a bundle.
It's the VIP one that's on Joyful Noise.
Joyful Noise does it, and they usually do a pretty good job of that. We also have like a four-song demo tape that's like four demo versions that we recorded ourselves of some of the songs that ended up on the record. So it's made to look like Jared did the J card in it, so it looks like a mixtape. So there's a bunch of bonus stuff like that, and it's fun to do all that stuff and pick it out and decide how it's going to look and how it's going to be presented.
When you're touring, are you going to have some additional special pressings? Like, you've got the bone version of The Beast You Are, the black version. Are there going to be other ones that you have exclusively on tour?
Those are the two versions that will be available for the tour, bone and the black vinyl. Yeah.
Okay. So the band enjoys selling vinyl, it sounds like. I mean, is it? I know it's heavier than T-shirts, but you don't have to deal with the sizes and that sort of stuff. So if you're looking at the merch table, the items that support the band the most are the vinyl, it sounds like. Is that right?
It's true. And it's fun because it like, in terms of a display, it like sells itself. Like, you don't have to make, like selling a CD, you have to make a sign that's like, here it is. It's this tiny postage stamp little thing right here, but you know, it's like big enough where you can see, you know, the product from behind the table. You can see the whole cover in detail. You can see everything. So that takes the extra work off of our shoulders, you know?
Yeah.
Now, but it's fun. Like people can pick it up and look at it and check it out. And Jared always does a really good job on the art. He always does the covers of the record. So it's cool. You can, you know, you don't have to squint to see it.
So I imagine, just being in the bands you've been in, the Murder City Devils, Melvins, of course now Big Business, these are bands that have really a legacy in terms of vinyl and special limited editions. Did you have a lot of vinyl in your youth? Did you come into music via vinyl?
I feel like, I mean, I always remember like listening to records at my dad's house when I was like super little. But I felt like when I had my own, I got a Walkman for like my fifth birthday, which is kind of a big deal back then, because it wasn't like a cheap toy. It was like the Sony Walkman. It took four AA batteries, and it was like the size of a VHS tape, you know, and it was like, it had a shoulder strap, you know, it weighed like 15 pounds or whatever. And I feel like I really came into like enjoying music through cassette tapes. You know, like, at first it was records, then it was cassettes. And that's where I, like, really, like, got into, you know, like, Judas Priest and Kiss and bands like that. Mm-hmm. And then, but it was always, like, the records were, like, the visual part of it. You know what I mean? Like going through my dad or my stepdad's record collection and seeing, like, opening up, you know, like, Kiss Alive and, you know, or the gatefold of Tres Hombres, ZZ Top. You know, it's like, what is, you know, huge, way more of a visual impact.
As I understand the story, you moved to Seattle around the early to mid-90s. What was the scene like mm-hmm. at that point?
It was, how do I say it? Like, there was a lot of bands there trying to, like, get big, I guess. Like, Nirvana had already happened. So it was, like, full blast grunge. Like, people moving to Seattle from San Diego or wherever to try to be a grunge band. And there was also, like, the younger kids, there's kind of a backlash to all that happening. And kids are getting more into, like, hardcore again or trying to, like, find their own identity away from that whole scene too. So it was pretty interesting. There's a lot going on.
Okay.
But it was cool.
Was there still the camaraderie or was it turning, superficial. It was turning into an industry at that point.
Yeah. But I feel like at that point it already had been an industry for a while. So it was kind of like everybody trying to milk the last whatever they could get out of it. You know, like you could kind of tell like, it was already going away. Like if you're trying to be a grunge band, you're kind of screwed because it like all the like Soundgarden had already happened and Nirvana had already happened and all these bands are already like have been the biggest band in the world. So I feel like things were definitely like moving on. So it was kind of like weeding. Everybody's kind of trying to glom onto that last gasp of glory out of that. And while there's a bunch of younger kids trying to like do something different than that. And so I just remember going to a lot of, like when I first moved there and I first met some of the guys I was in Murder City Devils with, there was just like tons of like house party shows and basement shows. And it was great. It was really, really fun. And there's just a lot of kids just being in bands and being crazy. And I've not been to parties like that since, you know, it was super great.
There's too many lawyers these days. That's why they don't have those parties like that anymore.
Maybe. Nah, we're just not invited anymore. You know,
the old guys. The Murder City Devils pop up in the midst of this post scene. Let's put it that way. What was the impetus for Murder City Devils? I mean, obviously you wanted to be in a band, but what was the space that the Murder City Devils filled?
We were just trying to be like, a lot of the guys in that band had been in hardcore bands for a long time and different punk bands. And like, I think everybody just wanted to play rock and roll in a way that was, newer. It was coming from that, origin point, you know, like hardcore kids playing rock and roll. Like that was kind of what we were trying to do in a way that, wasn't involved with grunge or wasn't involved with any of that. We're trying to make something new, but I guess it was kind of glorifying. It sounds weird, really weird to talk about now because it's like, yeah, we loved the Stooges more than any other band. You know what I mean? We loved it. And there just wasn't a lot of that going around at the time. Now it's like, you know, canon, like that's like, of course they're the greatest rock band in the world. Yeah. But at the time we were like, oh, we love the Stooges so much. They're amazing. Or the MC5, you know? And of course there are a bunch of other bands doing MC5 or doing Stooges stuff. And it was just, for us at the time in our little circle of friends, it was, something totally different that was happening. And, we thought we nailed it, but you know, whatever. it was fun.
Murder City Devils had this crazy reputation. Of course, the name probably got it 50% there. It felt like there was a circus following Murder City Devils. And this was, I believe, your first band. I mean, what was it like jumping right in the center of the fire with Murder City Devils?
It was great. Like going on tour, I had never left like the tiny corner of Washington State that I was born in, you know, like so actually making records with those guys and like getting in a van and driving across the country. And, it was probably the most like romantic time of my life, you know, like I can't even tell you what it was like to like, you know, and this is all before like cell phones or anything like that. This is like, we had a calling card and it was payphones and, it was really old timey. Yep. And we had an old like converted ambulance and we all piled into the van and just like booked our own tour and drove across the country, and every place we were every day was someplace I had never been before. And it was an adventure every night. Also, I have to say, like, that band, like, one of its greatest strengths was that, like, Spencer, as a lead singer, it's like we were trying to be, like, all these bands, but mostly because of him and how he is and just how he is as a performer and a person and the way his mind works, we could never be, like, any of those bands. We could only be, like, ourselves. And at times that was frustrating, like, when we were trying to, like, form our identity. But, like, in retrospect, it ended up being, like, our greatest strength and the reason we can still like play shows today. It's just like, he's not like anybody else. Like, it's not like any other band. And it took years to like realize that, but, yeah, like it was, I couldn't believe my luck when I fell in with those guys and we were actually like playing shows in front of people and people were having a super good time and you could feel the energy and I didn't think I would ever get to do something like that. It was really, really cool.
That's a pretty special introduction to what became your career. Now, I also understand you did karate for many years, martial arts. Did you have to ever use your martial arts on the road?
Not really. Like, we never got into anything that wasn't just like a full-on, like, sloppy bar brawl. It was just like pushing and shoving and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's no, like... switchblade attacks or anything where I had to I don't know.
I'm picturing like one of those Western bar fights where they're breaking the chairs over the people's heads.
We had one night in New Orleans that was a lot like that, actually, but it was like such a mob scene that it was more like being at a really intense concert, I guess, but it was people fighting. It ended with like our roadie like running full speed at the mob and just knocking everybody on their ass. And then we all got up and had to leave and get out of there. But, no late night, street brawls with chains or anything like that. No.
So Murder City Devils ran its course, the first part of its life anyway. And then around 2006, you joined Melvins as the second drummer next to Dale Grover. What challenges did that pose? What benefits did that bring?
Well, it was scary because he's one of my favorite drummers of all time. And so like being a Melvins fan and understanding how they are Melvins fans are very precious about the Melvins. Like they have an idea about what they like about the Melvins and they're very, very, very opinionated, very passionate about it. So knowing that, I was like, nobody is going to swallow this in a million years. Like I really had to steel myself to be like, everybody's going to hate me probably for this, but you know, cause it's Dale Crover. Why would you need a second drummer next to Dale Crover? That doesn't make any sense, which is why they did it in the first place, I think. Cause it didn't make any sense. And, it was great. It was real. I didn't know if it was going to work at first. Like Jared and I worked super hard on learning all the songs that they sent us. But we still didn't know until we were in the same room whether or not we could actually play together without it sounding like, you know, two dump trucks falling off a cliff. Like, and we figured out right away, once we finally got in the room together and played through the songs, we at least figured out that we could play together and have it sound good, you know? Right. So then it just became a point of like trying to figure out how to make two drummers make sense and the play on the strengths of how we played similar and how we played different.
Hmm. What did you learn most from Dale?
Well, I learned that he's definitely a special, he's imbued with his talent and he has a feel with his playing that you probably can't ever teach anybody. Mm-hmm. Like the way he makes decisions and what he decides to play and what not to play. I've never seen anybody play like him. Like it's very, very unique. And I understand knowing him and like understanding where he came from, his favorite drummers, like, you know, like John Bonham and like Bill Stevenson. And it still has this weird psychedelic quality that's real special, you know, and it's not like Dale is also one of the most musically educated people I've ever met in terms of like pop culture and bands. Like he knows everything about every band that's ever happened, you know, like he's insanely self-schooled in music history. And he's got a very special sensibility that you don't see in a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. So learning how to interact with that and guessing on what he was going to do and like the choices he was going to make and trying to fall in with that and dance around it and anticipate it. It made me a way better drummer just in terms of like thinking on my feet. Right. And also playing with another person in that way and going off of visual cues and stuff. There's a lot to it, but it was really, really fun. Like it's really fun to be able to like have someone next to you doing kind of the same thing you're doing and you egg each other on. And, there's like almost like a friendly competition going on where it's like, I'm not tired. Are you tired? No. Okay. You know, like that sort of thing. So it was great. Oh, yeah, I had a really good time playing with Dale.
And what sort of techniques or what things did you pick up from Dale and the Melvins that you still reference today? You still use in your musical language?
I don't know. I guess there's this really fine line that they have between, like you listen to some Melvin songs and you're like, that can't possibly be orchestrated. Like that can't be composed that way. Like they're just figuring it out as they go. And it's like they walk a really fine line between like composition and improvisation. Like there's everything is composed and everything you hear and see is on purpose, but there's also spots in there that are always improvised and it keeps things really interesting. And I always really like that about that, where there's, you don't feel as bad about playing the same song night after night when there's a little spot here and there where you have a chance to be free for a second and like, you know, do something different every night and make it special every night. And I always try to work that in to like when we play big business stuff, like I always like to have a little bit of freedom, you know, while still maintaining the overall character of the song.
Well, that's interesting because I just realized that Melvins really are a two-piece with friends, I guess, playing with them. I guess they have very much that kinetic sort of relationship that you and Jared do in Big Business, which means you can progress very quickly. The decision-making is minimal. It's only between two people, so you don't have to have additional coordination. Melvins could do very much the same thing, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Hmm. I mean, that you're exactly right. It's Buzz and Dale and whoever they decide to include, you know, and it always adds some different flavor to it. But yeah, that's the core, you know?
Yeah. Was there much room for improvisation?
Yeah. Like I said, we'd have, you know, depending on what the set was, there would be, you know, spaces in between songs in the set where we would improvise stuff. And there would always be like different parts in the songs where it'd be a drum break or something else going on where it wouldn't be exactly the same every night. It would be like, okay, this happens here and whatever happens in this space is going to be what it is that night. It might not be the same tomorrow or the night after that, but you know, there always be like these spaces for that to happen, which makes it fun for us. And isn't that what it's all about?
Yeah. It's funny. I don't know if you're a Marx Brothers fan, but I adore the Marx Brothers and the scripts. When they used to write the movies, they just leave a space that says Harpo does something here.
That's amazing. Awesome.
Sounds very similar. It. Now Melvins, of course, create a lot of vinyl, a lot of music. When it comes to creating the music, the singles, the records, that sort of thing, Buzz and Dale are clearly in charge. But do they just record everything and assemble stuff and then you find out about it when it's about ready to go? Or is there a willful plan to do an album, do a split? We're recording these songs for a single that's going to be on a special splatter edition for the tour. Like what involvement, what conversations happen around that?
Usually we get how it works. Buzz usually has an overarching like plan about like how, if it's going to be a record or if it's going to be a special thing, he's like, oh, we're going to do this. And I'm going to, you know, Buzz has a printing press at his house that he makes certain things, or sometimes, you know, they do stuff through Amphetamine Reptile where Tom Hazelmeyer will make a lino cut. So he'll have like an idea. He's like, okay, we're going to do, you know, we're going to make a 7-inch with this, and then like, Tom's going to do the cover, and then we'll record it for that. You know what I mean? Or we'll do, he usually has an idea in advance about how that release is going to come out. And then we would make the record around that. And there was a period where we kind of set up like a mobile studio where Toshi was recording everything, and we just recorded like for a month everything we could possibly think of to record. And I think, you know, it kind of got parceled out to different releases. Like, but it was just like every day we would record like three or four songs. And then that, I have no idea where all that stuff eventually ended up on a bunch of different, on a bunch of different stuff.
Well, it could still be coming out, you know, in the future.
Knows?
I think on Bases Loaded, there's some of that old material, or I won't say old material. But you know, material that you did when you were with the group. Do you just get made aware, oh, there's going to be a Melvins Patton Oswalt split 7-inch. Here's a couple copies.
Yeah. Sometimes that would happen. I remember we were on tour and, so there's this new show on called True Detective that people were talking about. And, we're in the middle of the tour and all of a sudden, like my phone started blowing up like, oh my God, you guys are on this soundtrack. And blah, blah, blah. I'm like, what? And I was like, I really like the show. And I was like, what? I was like, Buzz, are we on the True Detective soundtrack? He's like, huh? He's like, oh yeah. Oh yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. 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 We got this. Yeah. We're just like, oh my God. Like this show's amazing. Like really? And, that's happened a couple of times, but you know, those guys have so much like going on. Like, yeah, we weren't always 100% in the know about what was happening next.
Mm. Okay. Now, in terms of your music enjoyment experience, it sounds like you enjoy vinyl. Do you still enjoy cassettes or are you off those yet?
Nope. I have a record player at the house, and the records that I have that I usually like to listen to just for pure pleasure. And a lot of records that I've been on or involved with somehow. Mm-hmm. And then aside from that, it's mostly like I'm a geek about recording stuff. I like recording music, but I usually just listen to either records or I'll listen to, you know, in the car is where I listen to most of my music.
Mm. Okay. So your record collection is mostly your history.
There's a lot of that, but it's all like just pure what I listen to for pleasure, like Creedence Clearwater Revival, or you know, like Led Zeppelin, or certain country records. I have a bunch of soul records and stuff too. But like, there's not that many bands where I'm at home on my own time and I want to listen to some crazy abrasive avant punk rock music. Like I'm usually like want to listen to something that puts me in a serene mood or like a relaxed mood.
Well, fair enough. Are you precious about your records, or are you fine with the $5 bin, or do you look for a first pressing? Do you care?
I honestly, like, if I luck into it, awesome, but I just don't care that much. I've just never been a collector, I'm sorry to say. Just not in my, it's not in my DNA. And I've known so many pack rats and they just can't not do it, you know?
Yeah.
So there's this guy, you probably heard of him, Jello Biafra, who
can you say that name again? How do you spell that?
I don't know. I think it's pronounced yellow. He's a super nice guy, but he is like a dyed in the wool. He can't not collect. He can't not, like, I've stayed at his house before and his everything's alphabetized. Everything's totally cataloged. He has every demo tape that anyone's ever sent, Alternative Tentacles, cataloged and in a shoebox in his basement, like arranged. It's insane. We were big business just recently. We were playing in San Francisco and he came to the show and we had picked up, Jared just had his one of his grandparents had passed away and willed him a bunch of these old records that had been in the attic for who knows how long. So Jared didn't even really know what was in there. But we were loading and Jello was talking to us and he spied out of the corner of his eye this box of records in the back of our van while we were loading it. And he stopped us to be like, and you could tell that he was like almost upset. He was like, can I just flip through that real quick? Can I just see what you got? Can I just like, okay, man. he had to look through this box of records. Like he could not ask to do it. I was like, okay, I'm not that guy, you know?
Yeah. Oh man. Oh, well, unfortunately I think I am.
That's okay.
Well, I don't know. It really creates.
It means I don't have to do it, so I'm thankful.
Well, I'm glad that you pass up the records and allow them to stay for people Jello and I. But it comes at a psychic cost. I mean, there is anxiety.
Oh, sure.
Every time I drive by, let's say a yard sale, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, shit, I got to stop. In my mind, there's a box of Blue Note jazz pressings there that I'm just driving by, and so
yeah.
They have to stop. Yeah.
I feel bad, man. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I've known people like that over the years, and it's just like, yeah, it just must be it's an addiction, right? Like, it's like something that's like poking at you while you're going through your daily life. Like,
it is. No, quite honestly, it is. And, you know, I mean, think there are far worse addictions to be able to have. Everyone has to have something.
Totally.
I mean, if you're looking at your life and you're thinking, okay, well, you know, Nate collects records and so-and-so does something else. What is something that is in your wheelhouse that you are a bit worried about?
As far as like obsessiveness?
Yeah.
I mean, just like drumming and recording mostly. Like I've been getting way, way more into recording recently in the last couple of years, I guess. And it's really taken over my spare time as far as like what I'm thinking about. And I'm constantly thinking about like, okay, how do I like signal chains and how do I get this sound out of this? And okay, now what's my desert island, you know, preamp that I need that's going to get me this sound, and how do I put this over? How do I figure out this drum sound in this room? And you really can rabbit hole on that stuff. And it's between the technical aspect of it and the aesthetic and like what you're going for. It's just so endless. And there's no like grand reward at the end of it. You know what I mean? Like there's no like prize at the end. If you like pull it off, it's just like, it sounds good. And I don't know if anybody's going to care, if anybody's going to hear it or anything like that. So, that's what I have going on right now is just like obsessing about that stuff. And like, is this even going to pay off? And I don't know. Probably not.
Well, that's at least it's a creative adventure. I'm trying, like, I've got a couple of
kids,
a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old. And I've tried to kind of break down the world to them is you could spend your time creating or you could spend your time consuming. And, you know,
sure.
You could have, you know, it's not wrong to do either one, obviously, you know, but you want to have that balance. You don't want to always be doing video games because that's consuming. You're not creating anything, but you also want to have your own kind of things that you like to enjoy and spend your time doing it. So it sounds like from what your obsession is creation, which I think is quite healthy, where with me, the record buying can be quite consuming.
Sure. But you know, that can be something. I have some really good friends in San Francisco who, my friend Sunny, she lost her dad a couple years back, and he used to be an LD, lighting director at the Fillmore. I think it was in San Francisco, but he's since the 60s. So he has all these original posters from like Jimi Hendrix, and he was a total hoarder of all this stuff. But it's like he ran a record store as well. So they're going through all his stuff, and he has it's an unfathomable collection of posters, records, like all this stuff that's now it's worth. They don't even know. They're like sifting through it all, and everything they find, everything they unearth is like this crazy treasure. They had no idea he was hiding somewhere in his house.
Yeah.
You know,
they don't even know how to price it because it never comes up.
No, totally. Like they're just like, it's like their full-time job now is like going through all this stuff, like trying to like figure out like what to keep, what to, you know, like it's amazing, you know? And so I guess over the years, like, you know, if you have good taste and you hang on to the good stuff, like maybe your kids will reap the benefits someday. I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows? I was talking to a friend of mine, what am I going to do with my records when I die, which will hopefully not be anytime soon. But yeah, I've put together a bit of a plan just to make sure my kids, my family don't get burdened with some big record collection.
Oh, it could be the best thing that ever happened. Who knows? Not you dying, but the record collection.
Man. Believe me, it would that would bring down my anxiousness quite a bit. So Cody, I feel I could talk to you for several hours, but I do want to be respectful of your time. Now let's talk about the beast you are. So this album, where does this take us in the story of Big Business? How's the band grown with this album?
Well, our last record we made Command Your Weather was like our first record back to the two-piece lineup. And so that one was a challenge for us just in terms of can we do this? Can we make this happen again? And we did, and it was fun. And writing this new batch of songs, we were really, I was telling my wife, like, I was like, while we're writing all these songs, and I'm like, well, this record stinks. It won't be for lack of trying. Like, we worked super hard on it. Like, we were, but it does feel like, if this makes any sense, like, we're more ourselves now than we've ever been in our whole, like, our whole time together. Like, I felt like the first two records, which a lot of people are like, this is my favorite one or whatever. But I do feel like that was us still trying to figure out how to do this as two people and, like, how we were writing songs. And we weren't even married to the idea of remaining a two-piece, obviously, at that point. Like, we just happened to be in that situation. So I felt like we were going into writing this record. It was really like we were more comfortable with letting the songs present themselves a little bit more and focusing on groove and stuff a little bit more and building an atmosphere and letting the songs kind of like take care of themselves. Like, well, not like we weren't trying
like
at
autopilot.
All. And not to say that,
yeah.
Not like autopilot, but like, I guess like trusting ourselves and trusting the song and the process of building this house around this song and letting it go where it needs to go without like trying to like cram 150 million details and pieces in there, letting it breathe a little bit more, I guess. We spent a couple records trying to create the sense of atmosphere and depth when you hear it. Like, I've been trying to like, I want to hear the air in the room. I want to hear, I want you to be able to like, feel like you're in the room with the drum set. I want you to, you know, like, I don't want it to sound like a compressed, I don't want everything to be smashed in your face all the time. I want you to feel like you're in a long room with all this stuff and all the space and all these sounds and voices happening around you and that you're in it with all the, you know, dimension and depth. Like, we, and I feel like we finally like found that on this record. Like, I feel like it really it's layered, but it's also airy in places, and there's depth and dimension in there that in a way that I feel like we haven't achieved before.
Mm.
So I'm excited about that.
Now, how long does the music tend to gestate for you guys? What was the writing process and what was the recording process for this album?
Well, there's a couple songs on here that we've had for a couple years that we've been like riffs that we've been working on that we'll mess around with on tour. And recently on the last two records, we've taken to, we'll demo everything first, you know, instead of just writing the song, but we'll actually like record the song in our practice space as if we were recording it for the record and then, you know, tweak it from there when we actually go into the studio. So that's been helpful, but a lot of this, like the riffs and a couple of things that we've been hanging on to for a couple of years ended up coming out totally different than we anticipated. Like, and sometimes a couple of the songs ended up happening really quickly, like coming together really quickly. And it just happens that way sometimes. And it's okay. Like, some songs write themselves and they're done right away. And other songs, like I've always thought about this riff in this way. And then it just take this note out here and it becomes something totally different. And that's cool too. And it just, all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's the song that's always been there that we didn't realize. So, some of them happen really fast to answer your question. And there's a couple songs that we've had for a while that finally got put into place.
It sounds like when you go into recording, there's, you know, you've got some things that are known and some things that are unknown, and you just have to, you got to be comfortable knowing that things will come together. Is that, do you get nervous going into recording that magic may or may not happen?
I'm more nervous now about some technical thing fucking up our flow, like going in and like having some technical glitch in the studio where we're like, we're ready to go, we're practiced, we're set up, we got all the sounds, and then like, oh, like halfway into the first take, something doesn't work. And you know what I mean? Like, that feeling of being unable to build momentum is the worst. that's what I'm more scared of. I don't. Recording for us is such a, like, we pay for our own recordings, and that part of it, we take care of ourselves. So we make sure that we're as best as we can be, like, ready to lay these songs down when we go in. And that said, we always, like, talking about, like, spaces for improvisation earlier, we always, what needs to be nailed down is nailed down when we go in there, and we always do leave some spaces so that there's room to improvise and there's room to, like, put some fresh life in there somewhere, so it's not just a, we're not just hammering out 10 songs as we've, like, recorded them previously. So we like to have a little bit of room to, like, try stuff. Just so if there is a happy accident to be had, we give it a chance. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, Cody, I got to tell you, the magic did appear on this one. I want to encourage folks to check out the album The Beast You Are, a tremendous album from Big Business. There are, as Cody said, VIP limited edition vinyl as well as standard pressings. And I can't wait to get one and hear it as the band intended. You can go to facebook.com/bigbigbiz, B-I-Z or Z, depending on where you are at in the world, bigbigbusiness.bandcamp.com, or you can get some of the special pressing, some of the special packagings over at joyfulnoiserecordings.com. Cody, what are your touring plans for 2019?
Well, there's a lot of them. We're getting ready to go. I don't have them right in front of me, but we're getting ready to do a tour with the band Clutch in the U.S. And that's going to be running almost right up to where our record comes out, which is on April 12th, which we will be doing our own West Coast, Midwest headlining tour. And so that's going through May. And then I can't announce it yet, but when does this air, by the way?
I could do this as early as next week.
Well, there's another tour after that, but it can't be made public until, like, February 19th or so. So I don't know if I should say.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it involve a passport?
It doesn't, but we do have plans to go to Europe in the fall.
Oh, okay.
So that's being finalized right now.
Okay. Again, everyone go to facebook.com/bigbigbiz and follow Big Business and see this band live. I can't wait to see how you guys pull this off. It is a phenomenal album, The Beast You Are. And if I ever get in your neighborhood, I'm definitely going to be right up front. Thanks for coming on the show, Cody.
Thanks, Nate.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cody, for coming on The Vinyl Guide. And I got to say, I'm a convert. I am a Big Business fan. I wasn't even aware of them a month ago, and now I am fully on board. The new album, The Beast You Are, really kicks ass. I've already ordered my splatter version, and I'm looking forward to catching this band live. Of course, you want to go to bigbigbusiness.bandcamp.com, order yourself a vinyl, or there's actually some special pressings at joyfulnoiserecordings.com. The splatters and stuff are up there, so joyfulnoiserecordings.com. And of course, follow them on Facebook, facebook.com/bigbigbiz, and then you'll be able to know when they come into your town, and hopefully you'll be able to catch these guys live. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you for tuning in. I really do appreciate it. Please share these episodes with your friends. Put them on your social media, your friend, your family. Hell, even your enemies will enjoy these. Also, your record buddies who have those smartphones and aren't quite sure how to get podcasts. Spend a few minutes with them. Show them how to download the Vinyl Guide mobile apps. They're really easy. Apple, iTunes, Apple Store, whatever you call it, or the Android Store. Just search for The Vinyl Guide, and should be no problem installing those. You'll be able to get access to every single episode, every interview, every little syllable that I've uttered on this podcast is available through those apps. Or you can figure it out through Apple Podcasts, whatever the case may be. Anyway, look, I gotta go. You've got stuff to do too. I'm gonna be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.